it to Dumbledore, transformed again into the black dog, and ran the length of the room to the door, whose handle he turned with a paw. Then he was gone. "Severus!" said Dumbledore, turning to Snape. "You know what I must ask you to do, if you are ready, if you are prepared." "I am," said Snape. He looked slightly paler than usual, and his cold black eyes glittered strangely. "Then good luck," said Dumbledore, and he watched with a trace of apprehension on his face as Snape swept wordlessly after Sirius. It was several minutes before Dumbledore spoke again. "I must go downstairs," he said finally. "I must see the Diggories. Harry, take the rest of your potion. I will see all of you later." Harry slumped back against his pillows as Dumbledore disappeared. Hermione, Ron, and Mrs. Weasley were all looking at him. None of them spoke for a very long time. "You've got to take the rest of your potion, Harry," Mrs. Weasley said at last. Her hand nudged the sack of gold on his bedside cabinet as she reached for the bottle and the goblet. "You have a good long sleep. Try and think about something else for a while. Think about what you're going to buy with your winnings." "I don't want that gold," said Harry in an expressionless voice. "You have it. Anyone can have it. I shouldn't have won it. It should have been Cedric's." The thing against which he had been fighting on and off ever since he had come out of the maze was threatening to overpower him. He could feel a burning, prickling feeling in the inner corners of his eyes. He blinked and stared up at the ceiling. "It wasn't your fault, Harry," Mrs. Weasley whispered. "I told him to take the cup with me," said Harry. Now the burning feeling was in his throat, too. He wished Ron would look away. Mrs. Weasley set the potion down on the bedside cabinet, bent down, and put her arms around Harry. He had no memory of ever being hugged like this, as though by a mother. The full weight of everything he had seen that night seemed to fall in upon him as Mrs. Weasley held him to her. His mother's face, his father's voice, the sight of Cedric dead on the ground, all started spinning in his head until he could hardly bear it, until he was screwing up his face against the howl of misery fighting to get out of him. There was a loud slamming noise, and Mrs. Weasley and Harry broke apart. Hermione was standing by the window. She was holding something tight in her hand.
"Sorry," she whispered.
"Your potion, Harry," said Mrs. Weasley quickly, wiping her eyes on the back of her hand. Harry drank it in one gulp. The effect was instantaneous. Heavy, irresistible waves of dreamless sleep broke over him. He fell back onto his pillows and thought no more. Chapter 37 The Beginning. When he looked back, even a month later, Harry found he had only scattered memories of the next few days. It was as though he had been through too much to take in any more. The recollections he did have were very painful. The worst, perhaps, was the meeting with the Diggories that took place the following morning. They did not blame him for what had happened. On the contrary, both thanked him for returning Cedric's body to them. Mr. Diggory sobbed through most of the interview. Mrs. Diggory's grief seemed to be beyond tears.
"He suffered very little then," she said, when Harry had told her how Cedric had died.
"And after all, Amos, he died just when he'd won the tournament. He must have been happy."
When they got to their feet, she looked down at Harry and said,
"You look after yourself now."
Harry seized the sack of gold on the bedside table.
"You take this," he muttered to her. "It should have been Cedric's. He got there first. You take it."
But she backed away from him.
"Oh, no. It's yours, dear. I couldn't. You keep it."
Harry returned to Gryffindor Tower the following evening. From what Hermione and Ron told him, Dumbledore had spoken to the school that morning at breakfast. He had merely requested that they leave Harry alone, that nobody ask him questions or badger him to tell the story of what had happened in the maze. Most people, he noticed, were skirting him in the corridors, avoiding his eyes. Some whispered behind their hands as he passed. He guessed that many of them had believed Rita Skeeter's article about how disturbed and possibly dangerous he was. Perhaps they were formulating their own theories about how Cedric had died. He found he didn't care very much. He liked it best when he was with Ron and Hermione, and they were talking about other things, or else letting him sit in silence while they played chess. He felt as though all three of them had reached an understanding they didn't need to put into words, that each was waiting for some sign, some word, of what was going on outside Hogwarts, and that it was useless to speculate about what might be coming until they knew anything for certain. The only time they touched upon the subject was when Ron told Harry about a meeting Mrs. Weasley had had with Dumbledore before going home.
"She went to ask him if you could come straight to us this summer," he said. "But he wants you to go back to the Dursleys, at least at first."
"Why?" said Harry.
"She said Dumbledore's got his reasons," said Ron, shaking his head darkly. "I suppose we've got to trust him, haven't we?"
The only person apart from Ron and Hermione that Harry felt able to talk to was Hagrid. As there was no longer a defense against the dark arts teacher, they had those lessons free. They used the one on Thursday afternoon to go down and visit Hagrid in his cabin. It was a bright and sunny day. Fang bounded out of the open door as they approached, barking and wagging his tail madly.
"Who's that?" called Hagrid, coming to the door. "Harry!"
He strode out to meet them, pulled Harry into a one-armed hug, ruffled his hair and said,
"Good to see you, mate. Good to see you."
They saw two bucket-sized cups and saucers on the wooden table in front of the fireplace when they entered Hagrid's cabin.
"Been having a cuppa with old Limp," Hagrid said. "She just left."
"Who?" said Ron curiously.
"Madame Maxime, of course," said Hagrid.
"You two made up, have you?" said Ron.
"Dunno what you're talking about,"
said Hagrid airily, fetching more cups from the dresser. When he had made tea and offered around a plate of doughy cookies, he leaned back in his chair and surveyed Harry closely through his beetle-black eyes.
"You all right?"
he said gruffly.
"Yeah," said Harry.
"No, you're not,"
said Hagrid.
"Course you're not, but you will be."
Harry said nothing.
"Knew he was going to come back,"
said Hagrid, and Harry, Ron and Hermione looked up at him, shocked.
"Known it for years, Harry. Knew he was out there biding his time. It had to happen. Well, now it has, and we'll just have to get on with it. We'll fight. Might be able to stop him before he gets a good old. That's Dumbledore's plan, anyway. Great man, Dumbledore. So long as we've got him, I'm not too worried."
Hagrid raised his bushy eyebrows at the disbelieving expressions on their faces.
"No good sitting worrying about it," he said. "What's coming will come, and we'll meet it when it does. Dumbledore told me what you did, Harry."
Hagrid's chest swelled as he looked at Harry.
"You did as much as your father would have done, and I can give you no higher praise than that."
Harry smiled back at him. It was the first time he'd smiled in days.
"What's Dumbledore asked you to do, Hagrid?" he asked. "He sent Professor McGonagall to ask you and Madame Maxime to meet him that night."
"Got a little job for me over the summer," said Hagrid. "Secret, though. I'm not supposed to talk about it. No, not even to you lot. Oh, Limp, Madame Maxime to you, might be coming with me. I think she will. I think I got her persuaded."
"Is it to do with Voldemort?"
Hagrid flinched at the sound of the name.
"Might be," he said evasively. "Now, who'd like to come and visit the last scroot with me? I was joking, joking,"
he added hastily, seeing the looks on their faces. It was with a heavy heart that Harry packed his trunk up in the dormitory on the night before his return to Privet Drive. He was dreading the leaving feast, which was usually a cause for celebration, when the winner of the Interhouse Championship would be announced. He had avoided being in the Great Hall when it was full ever since he had left the hospital wing, preferring to eat when it was nearly empty to avoid the stares of his fellow students. When he, Ron and Hermione entered the hall, they saw at once that the usual decorations were missing. The Great Hall was normally decorated with the winning house's colours for the leaving feast. Tonight, however, there were black drapes on the wall behind the teacher's table. Harry knew instantly that they were there as a mark of respect to Cedric. The real Mad-Eye Moody was at the staff table now, his wooden leg and his magical eye back in place. He was extremely twitchy, jumping every time someone spoke to him. Harry couldn't blame him. Moody's fear of attack was bound to have been increased by his 10-month imprisonment in his own trunk. Professor Karkaroff's chair was empty. Harry wondered as he sat down with the other Gryffindors where Karkaroff was now, and whether Voldemort had caught up with him. Madame Maxime was still there. She was sitting next to Hagrid. They were talking quietly together. Further along the table, sitting next to Professor McGonagall, was Snape. His eyes lingered on Harry for a moment as Harry looked at him. His expression was difficult to read. He looked as sour and unpleasant as ever. Harry continued to watch him, long after Snape had looked away. What was it that Snape had done on Dumbledore's orders the night that Voldemort had returned? And why was Dumbledore so convinced that Snape was truly on their side? He had been their spy. Dumbledore had said so in the pensive. Snape had turned spy against Voldemort at great personal risk. Was that the job he had taken up again? Had he made contact with the Death Eaters, perhaps? Pretended that he had never really gone over to Dumbledore, that he had been, like Voldemort himself, biding his time? Harry's musings were ended by Professor Dumbledore, who stood up at the staff table. The great hall, which in any case had been less noisy than it usually was at the leaving feast, became very quiet. "The end," said Dumbledore, looking around at them all, "of another year." He paused, and his eyes fell upon the Hufflepuff table. Theirs had been the most subdued table before he had gotten to his feet, and theirs were still the saddest and palest faces in the hall. "There is much that I would like to say to you all tonight," said Dumbledore, "but I must first acknowledge the loss of a very fine person who should be sitting here." He gestured toward the Hufflepuffs, "enjoying our feast with us. I would like you all, please, to stand and raise your glasses to Cedric Diggory." They did it, all of them. The benches scraped as everyone in the hall stood and raised their goblets and echoed in one loud, low, rumbling voice, "Cedric Diggory." Harry caught a glimpse of Cho through the crowd. There were tears pouring silently down her face. He looked down at the table as they all sat down again. "Cedric was a person who exemplified many of the qualities that distinguish Hufflepuff House," Dumbledore continued. "He was a good and loyal friend, a hard worker. He valued fair play. His death has affected you all, whether you knew him well or not. I think that you have the right, therefore, to know exactly how it came about."
Harry raised his head and stared at Dumbledore.
"Cedric Diggory was murdered by Lord Voldemort."
A panicked whisper swept the great hall. People were staring at Dumbledore in disbelief, in horror. He looked perfectly calm as he watched them mutter themselves into silence.
"The Ministry of Magic," Dumbledore continued, "does not wish me to tell you this. It is possible that some of your parents will be horrified that I have done so, either because they will not believe that Lord Voldemort has returned, or because they think I should not tell you so, young as you are. It is my belief, however, that the truth is generally preferable to lies, and that any attempt to pretend that Cedric died as the result of an accident or some sort of blunder of his own is an insult to his memory."
Stunned and frightened, every face in the hall was turned toward Dumbledore now, or almost every face. Over at the Slytherin table, Harry saw Draco Malfoy muttering something to Crabbe and Goyle. Harry felt a hot, sick swoop of anger in his stomach. He forced himself to look back at Dumbledore.
"There is somebody else who must be mentioned in connection with Cedric's death," Dumbledore went on. "I am talking, of course, about Harry Potter."
A kind of ripple crossed the great hall as a few heads turned in Harry's direction before flicking back to face Dumbledore.
"Harry Potter managed to escape Lord Voldemort," said Dumbledore. "He risked his own life to return Cedric's body to Hogwarts. He showed in every respect the sort of bravery that few wizards have ever shown in facing Lord Voldemort, and for this
I honour him."
Dumbledore turned gravely to Harry and raised his goblet once more. Nearly everyone in the great hall followed suit. They murmured his name, as they had murmured Cedric's, and drank to him. But through a gap in the standing figures, Harry saw that Malfoy, Crabbe, Goyle, and many of the other Slytherins had remained defiantly in their seats, their goblets untouched. Dumbledore, who after all possessed no magical eye, did not see them. When everyone had once again resumed their seats, Dumbledore continued,
"The Triwizard Tournament's aim was to further and promote magical understanding. In the light of what has happened, of Lord Voldemort's return, such ties are more important than ever before."
Dumbledore looked from Madame Maxime and Hagrid to Fleur Delacour and her fellow Beauxbatons students, to Victor Crumb and the Durmstrangs at the Slytherin table. Crumb, Harry saw, looked wary, almost frightened, as though he expected Dumbledore to say something harsh.
"Every guest in this hall," said Dumbledore,
and his eyes lingered upon the Durmstrang students,
"will be welcomed back here at any time, should they wish to come. I say to you all, once again, in the light of Lord Voldemort's return, we are only as strong as we are united, as weak as we are divided. Lord Voldemort's gift for spreading discord and enmity is very great. We can fight it only by showing an equally strong bond of friendship and trust. Differences of habit and language are nothing at all if our aims are identical and our hearts are open. It is my belief, and never have I so hoped that I am mistaken, that we are all facing dark and difficult times. Some of you in this hall have already suffered directly at the hands of Lord Voldemort. Many of your families have been torn asunder. A week ago, a student was taken from our midst. Remember, Cedric. Remember, if the time should come when you have to make a choice between what is right and what is easy, remember what happened to a boy who was good and kind and brave, because he strayed across the path of Lord Voldemort. Remember Cedric Diggory."
Harry's trunk was packed. Hedwig was back in her cage on top of it. He, Ron, and Hermione were waiting in the crowded entrance hall with the rest of the 4th years for the carriages that would take them back to Hogsmeade Station. It was another beautiful summer's day. He supposed the Privet Drive would be hot and leafy, its flower beds a riot of colour when he arrived there that evening. The thought gave him no pleasure at all.
"Harry!"
He looked around. Fleur Delacour was hurrying up the stone steps into the castle. Beyond her, far across the grounds, Harry could see Hagrid helping Madame Maxime to back 2 of the giant horses into their harness. The Beauxbatons' carriage was about to take off.
"We will see each other again, I hope,"
said Fleur, as she reached him, holding out her hand.
"I am hoping to get a job here, to improve my English." "It's very good already,"
said Ron in a strangled sort of voice. Fleur smiled at him. Hermione scowled.
"Goodbye, Harry,"
said Fleur, turning to go.
"It has been a pleasure meeting you."
Harry's spirits couldn't help but lift slightly as he watched Fleur hurry back across the lawns to Madame Maxime, her silvery hair rippling in the sunlight.
"Wonder how the Durmstrang students are getting back," said Ron. "Do you reckon they can steer that ship without Karkaroff?"
"Karkaroff did not steer," said a gruff voice. "He stayed in his cabin and let us do the work."
Crumb had come to say goodbye to Hermione.
"Could I have a word?"
he asked her.
"Oh, yes. All right,"
said Hermione, looking slightly flustered, and following Crumb through the crowd and out of sight.
"You'd better hurry up," Ron called loudly after her. "The carriages will be here in a minute."
He let Harry keep a watch for the carriages, however, and spent the next few minutes craning his neck over the crowd to try and see what Crumb and Hermione might be up to. They returned quite soon. Ron stared at Hermione, but her face was quite impassive.
"I liked Diggory," said Crumb abruptly to Harry. "He was always polite to me, always, even though I was from Durmstrang, with Karkaroff," he added, scowling.
"Have you got a new headmaster yet?" said Harry.
Crumb shrugged. He held out his hand as Fleur had done, shook Harry's hand, and then Ron's. Ron looked as though he was suffering some sort of painful internal struggle. Crumb had already started walking away when Ron burst out,
"Can I have your autograph?"
Hermione turned away, smiling at the horseless carriages that were now trundling toward them up the drive, as Crumb, looking surprised but gratified, signed a fragment of parchment for Ron. The weather could not have been more different on the journey back to King's Cross than it had been on their way to Hogwarts the previous September. There wasn't a single cloud in the sky. Harry, Ron and Hermione had managed to get a compartment to themselves. Pigwidgeon was once again hidden under Ron's dress robes to stop him from hooting continually. Hedwig was dozing, her head under her wing, and Crookshanks was curled up in a spare seat like a large, furry ginger cushion. Harry, Ron, and Hermione talked more fully and freely than they had all week as the train sped them southward. Harry felt as though Dumbledore's speech at the leaving feast had unblocked him somehow. It was less painful to discuss what had happened now. They broke off their conversation about what action Dumbledore might be taking even now to stop Voldemort, only when the lunch trolley arrived. When Hermione returned from the trolley and put her money back into her school bag, she dislodged a copy of the Daily Prophet that she had been carrying in there. Harry looked at it, unsure whether he really wanted to know what it might say. But Hermione, seeing him looking at it, said calmly,
"There's nothing in there. You can look for yourself, but there's nothing at all. I've been checking every day, just a small piece the day after the third task saying you won the tournament. They didn't even mention Cedric. Nothing about any of it. If you ask me, Fudge is forcing them to keep quiet."
"He'll never keep Rita quiet," said Harry. "Not on a story like this."
"Oh, Rita hasn't written anything at all since the third task," said Hermione in an oddly constrained voice. "As a matter of fact," she added, her voice now trembling slightly, "Rita Skeeter isn't going to be writing anything at all for a while, not unless she wants me to spill the beans on her."
"What are you talking about?" said Ron.
"I found out how she was listening in on private conversations when she wasn't supposed to be coming onto the grounds," said Hermione in a rush.
Harry had the impression that Hermione had been dying to tell them this for days, but that she had restrained herself in light of everything else that had happened.
"How was she doing it?" said Harry at once.
"How did you find out?" said Ron, staring at her.
"Well, it was you really who gave me the idea, Harry," she said.
"Did I?" said Harry, perplexed.
"How?"
"Bugging," said Hermione happily.
"But you said they didn't work." "Oh, not electronic bugs," said Hermione. "No, you see, Rita Skeeter,"
Hermione's voice trembled with quiet triumph,
"is an unregistered animagus. She can turn,"
Hermione pulled a small sealed glass jar out of her bag,
"into a beetle."
"You're kidding," said Ron. "You haven't—"
"She's not—"
"Oh, yes, she is,"
said Hermione happily, brandishing the jar at them. Inside were a few twigs and leaves, and one large, fat beetle.
"That's never—" "You're kidding,"
Ron whispered, lifting the jar to his eyes.
"No, I'm not," said Hermione, beaming. "I caught her on the windowsill in the hospital wing. Look very closely, and you'll notice the markings around her antennae are exactly like those foul glasses she wears."
Harry looked and saw that she was quite right. He also remembered something.
"There was a beetle on the statue the night we heard Hagrid telling Madame Maxime about his mum." "Exactly," said Hermione, "and Victor pulled a beetle out of my hair after we'd had our conversation by the lake. And, unless I'm very much mistaken, Rita was perched on the windowsill of the divination class the day your scar hurt. She's been buzzing around for stories all year."
"When we saw Malfoy under that tree," said Ron slowly,
"he was talking to her in his hand," said Hermione. "He knew, of course. That's how she's been getting all those nice little interviews with the Slytherins. They wouldn't care that she was doing something illegal, as long as they were giving her horrible stuff about us and Hagrid."
Hermione took the glass jar back from Ron and smiled at the beetle, which buzzed angrily against the glass.
"'I've told her I'll let her out when we get back to London,' said Hermione. "'I've put an unbreakable charm on the jar, you see, so she can't transform. "'And I've told her she's to keep her quill to herself for a whole year, "'see if she can't break the habit of writing horrible lies about people.'
"'Smiling serenely, Hermione placed the beetle back inside her school bag. "'The door of the compartment slid open.
"'Very clever, Granger,' said Draco Malfoy.
"'Crabbe and Goyle were standing behind him. "'All three of them looked more pleased with themselves, "'more arrogant and more menacing than Harry had ever seen them.
"'So,'
said Malfoy slowly, "'advancing slightly into the compartment "'and looking slowly around at them, "'a smirk quivering on his lips.
"'You caught some pathetic reporter "'and Potter's Dumbledore's favourite boy again. "'Big deal.'
His smirk widened. Crabbe and Goyle leered.
"'Trying not to think about it, are we?'
said Malfoy softly, looking around at all three of them.
"'Trying to pretend it hasn't happened?'
"'Get out!'
said Harry. He had not been this close to Malfoy since he had watched him muttering to Crabbe and Goyle during Dumbledore's speech about Cedric. He could feel a kind of ringing in his ears. His hand gripped his wand under his robes.
"'You've picked the losing side, Potter. "'I warned you. "'I told you you ought to choose your company more carefully, remember? "'When we met on the train first day at Hogwarts. "'I told you not to hang around with riffraff like this.'
"'He jerked his head at Ron and Hermione.
"'Too late now, Potter. "'They'll be the first to go, now the Dark Lord's back.' "'Mudbloods and muggle lovers first. "'Well, second. "'Diggory was the
It was as though someone had exploded a box of fireworks within the compartment, blinded by the blaze of the spells that had blasted from every direction, deafened by a series of bangs. Harry blinked and looked down at the floor. Malfoy, Crabbe and Goyle were all lying unconscious in the doorway. He, Ron, and Hermione were on their feet, all three of them having used a different hex, nor were they the only ones to have done so.
"'Thought we'd see what those three were up to,'
said Fred, matter-of-factly, stepping onto Goyle and into the compartment. He had his wand out, and so did George, who was careful to tread on Malfoy as he followed Fred inside.
"'Interesting effect,' said George, looking down at Crabbe. "'Who used the furnunculus curse?'
"'Me,' said Harry.
"'Odd,' said George lightly. "'I used jelly legs.
"'Looks as though those two shouldn't be mixed. "'He seems to have sprouted little tentacles all over his face.
"'Well, let's not leave them here. "'They don't add much to the decor.'
"'Ron, Harry, and George kicked, rolled, and pushed the unconscious Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle, "'each of whom looked distinctly the worse for the jumble of jinxes "'with which they had been hit, out into the corridor.' Then came back into the compartment and rolled the door shut.
"'Exploding snap, anyone?'
said Fred, pulling out a pack of cards.
They were halfway through their fifth game when Harry decided to ask them. "'You going to tell us, then,' he said to George, "'who you were blackmailing?'
"'Oh,' said George darkly, "'that.'
"'It doesn't matter,' said Fred, shaking his head impatiently. "'It wasn't anything important. Not now, anyway.'
"'We've given up,' said George, shrugging. But Harry, Ron, and Hermione kept on asking, and finally Fred said,
all right, if you really want to know—'
It was Ludo Bagman.
"'Bagman?' said Harry sharply. "'Are you saying he was involved in—'
"'Nah,' said George gloomily.
"'Nothing like that, stupid git. He wouldn't have the brains.'
"'Well, what then?'
said Ron. Fred hesitated, then said,
"'You remember that bet we had with him at the Quidditch World Cup, about how Ireland would win, but Crumb would get the snitch?'
"'Yeah,'
said Harry and Ron slowly.
"'Well, the git paid us in leprechaun gold he'd caught from the Irish mascots.'
"'So,'
said Fred impatiently,
"'it vanished, didn't it? By next morning it had gone.'
"'But it must have been an accident, mustn't it?'
said Hermione. George laughed very bitterly.
"'Yeah, that's what we thought at first. We thought if we just wrote to him and told him he'd made a mistake, he'd cough up. But nothing doing. Ignored our letter.
We kept trying to talk to him about it at Hogwarts, but he was always making some excuse to get away from us.
In the end, he turned pretty nasty, said Fred.
Told us we were too young to gamble and he wasn't giving us anything.
So we asked for our money back, said George, glowering.
He didn't refuse, gasped Hermione.
Right in one, said Fred.
But that was all your savings, said Ron.
Tell me about it, said George. Course, we found out what was going on in the end. Lee Jordan's dad had had a bit of trouble getting money off Bagman as well. Turns out he's in big trouble with the goblins, borrowed loads of gold off them. A gang of them cornered him in the woods after the World Cup and took all the gold he had, and it still wasn't enough to cover all his debts. They followed him all the way to Hogwarts to keep an eye on him. He's lost everything gambling, hasn't got two galleons to rub together, and you know how the idiot tried to pay the goblins back?
How? Said Harry.
He put a bet on you, mate, said Fred. Put a big bet on you to win the tournament. Bet against the goblins.
So that's why he kept trying to help me win, said Harry.
Well, I did win, didn't I? So he can pay you your gold.
Nope, said George, shaking his head. The goblins play as dirty as him. They say you drew with Diggory, and Bagman was betting you'd win outright. So Bagman had to run for it. He did run for it, right after the third task.
George sighed deeply and started dealing out the cards again. The rest of the journey passed pleasantly enough. Harry wished it could have gone on all summer, in fact, and that he would never arrive at King's Cross. But as he had learned the hard way that year, time will not slow down when something unpleasant lies ahead. And all too soon, the Hogwarts Express was pulling in at platform 9 3/4. The usual confusion and noise filled the corridors as the students began to disembark. Ron and Hermione struggled out past Malfoy, Crabbe and Goyle, carrying their trunks. Harry, however, stayed put.
Fred, George, wait a moment.
The twins turned. Harry pulled open his trunk and drew out his Triwizard winnings.
Take it, he said,
and he thrust the sack into George's hands.
What? Said Fred, looking flabbergasted.
Take it, Harry repeated firmly. I don't want it.
You're mental,
said George, trying to push it back at Harry.
No, I'm not, said Harry. You take it and get inventing. It's for the joke shop.
He is mental, Fred said in an almost awed voice.
Listen, said Harry firmly, if you don't take it, I'm throwing it down the drain. I don't want it and I don't need it.
But I could do with a few laughs. We could all do with a few laughs. I've got a feeling we're going to need them more than usual before long.
Harry, said George weakly, weighing the money bag in his hands, there's got to be 1,000 galleons in here.
Yeah, said Harry, grinning. Think how many canary creams that is.
The twins stared at him. Just don't tell your mum where you got it, although she might not be so keen for you to join the ministry any more, come to think of it.
Harry, Fred began, but Harry pulled out his wand. Look, he said flatly, take it, or I'll hex you. I know some good ones now. Just do me one favour, okay? Buy Ron some different dress robes and say they're from you.
He left the compartment before they could say another word, stepping over Malfoy, Crabbe and Goyle, who was still lying on the floor, covered in hex marks.
Uncle Vernon was waiting beyond the barrier. Mrs. Weasley was close by him. She hugged Harry very tightly when she saw him and whispered in his ear,
I think Dumbledore will let you come to us later in the summer. Keep in touch, Harry.
See you, Harry, said Ron, clapping him on the back.
Bye, Harry,
said Hermione, and she did something she had never done before and kissed him on the cheek.
Harry, thanks, George muttered, while Fred nodded fervently at his side.
Harry winked at them, turned to Uncle Vernon, and followed him silently from the station. There was no point worrying yet, he told himself, as he got into the back of the Dursleys' car. As Hagrid had said, what would come, and he would have to meet it when it did.
Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire was read by Jim Dale. Text copyright J.K. Rowling 2000. Recording copyright Listening Library 2000. An imprint of the Penguin Random House Audio Publishing Group. Digitally remastered by Pottermore at Pinewood Studios in 2015. Pottermore is the digital entertainment, news and e-commerce company from J.K. Rowling, inspired by her Harry Potter books and the wider wizarding world. Pottermore is a place for Harry Potter fans to be entertained and discover more of the wizarding world they love through Pottermore.com experiences or products including Harry Potter ebooks, digital audiobooks and more. Harry Potter characters, names and related indicia are trademarks and copyright of Warner Brothers Entertainment. The story continues. Find out what happens next in this preview of the digital audiobook Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix by J.K. Rowling. Text copyright J.K. Rowling 2003. Recording copyright Listening Library 2003. An imprint of the Penguin Random House Audio Publishing Group.
Chapter 1. Dudley Demented. The hottest day of the summer so far was drawing to a close, and a drowsy silence lay over the large, square houses of Privet Drive. Cars that were usually gleaming stood dusty in their drives, and lawns that were once emerald green lay parched and yellowing. The use of hosepipes had been banned due to drought. Deprived of their usual car-washing and lawn-mowing pursuits, the inhabitants of Privet Drive had retreated into the shade of their cool houses, windows thrown wide in the hope of tempting in a non-existent breeze. The only person left outdoors was a teenage boy who was lying flat on his back in a flower bed outside number 4. He was a skinny, black-haired, bespectacled boy who had the pinched, slightly unhealthy look of someone who has grown a lot in a short space of time. His jeans were torn and dirty, his T-shirt baggy and faded, and the soles of his trainers were peeling away from the uppers. Harry Potter's appearance did not endear him to the neighbors, who were the sort of people who thought scruffiness ought to be punishable by law. But as he had hidden himself behind a large hydrangea bush this evening, he was quite invisible to passers-by. In fact, the only way he would be spotted was if his Uncle Vernon or Aunt Petunia stuck their heads out of the living-room window and looked straight down into the flower-bed below. On the whole, Harry thought he was to be congratulated on his idea of hiding here. He was not perhaps very comfortable lying on the hot, hard earth, but on the other hand, nobody was glaring at him, grinding their teeth so loudly that he could not hear the news, or shooting nasty questions at him, as had happened every time he had tried sitting down in the living room and watching television with his aunt and uncle. Almost as though this thought had fluttered through the open window, Vernon Dursley, Harry's uncle, suddenly spoke.
"Glad to see the boys stop trying to butt in. Where is he, anyway?"
"I don't know," said Aunt Petunia, unconcernedly.
"Not in the house."
Uncle Vernon grunted.
"Watching the news," he said scathingly. "I'd like to know what he's really up to. As if a normal boy cares what's on the news. Dudley hasn't got a clue what's going on. Doubt he knows who the Prime Minister is. Anyway, it's not as if there'd be anything about his lot on our news."
"Vernon, shush," said Aunt Petunia. "The window's open."
"Oh, yes. Sorry, dear."
The Dursleys fell silent. Harry listened to a jingle about fruit and bran breakfast cereal while he watched Mrs. Fig, a batty, cat-loving old lady from nearby Wisteria Walk, amble slowly past. She was frowning and muttering to herself. Harry was very pleased that he was concealed behind the bush. Mrs. Fig had recently taken to asking him around for tea whenever she met him in the street. She had rounded the corner and vanished from view before Uncle Vernon's voice floated out of the window again.
"Dadda's out for tea?"
"At the Pole Kisses,"
said Aunt Petunia fondly.
"He's got so many little friends. He's so popular."
Harry repressed a snort with difficulty. The Dursleys really were astonishingly stupid about their son Dudley. They had swallowed all his dim-witted lies about having tea with a different member of his gang every night of the summer holidays. Harry knew perfectly well that Dudley had not been to tea anywhere. He and his gang spent every evening vandalizing the play park, smoking on street corners, and throwing stones at passing cars and children. Harry had seen them at it during his evening walks around Little Whinging. He had spent most of the holidays wandering the streets, scavenging newspapers from bins along the way. The opening notes of the music that heralded the 7 o'clock news reached Harry's ears, and his stomach turned over. Perhaps tonight, after a month of waiting, would be the night. Record numbers of stranded holidaymakers fill airports as the Spanish baggage handlers' strike reaches its second week.
Give 'em a lifelong siesta, I would, snarled Uncle Vernon over the end of the newsreader's sentence, but no matter.
Outside in the flower bed, Harry's stomach seemed to unclench. If anything had happened, it would surely have been the first item on the news. Death and destruction were more important than stranded holidaymakers. He let out a long, slow breath and stared up at the brilliant blue sky. Every day this summer had been the same. The tension, the expectation, the temporary relief, and then mounting tension again. And always growing more insistent all the time, the question of why nothing had happened yet. He kept listening just in case there was some small clue, not recognized for what it really was by the Muggles, an unexplained disappearance, perhaps, or some strange accident. But the baggage handler's strike was followed by news on the drought in the southeast.
I hope he's listening next door, bellowed Uncle Vernon, with his sprinklers on at 3 in the morning.
Then a helicopter that had almost crashed in a field in Surrey. Then a famous actress's divorce from her famous husband.
As if we're interested in their sordid affairs,
sniffed Aunt Petunia, who had followed the case obsessively in every magazine she could lay her bony hands on. Harry closed his eyes against the now blazing evening sky, as the newsreader said.
And finally, Bungie the Budgie has found a novel way of keeping cool this summer. Bungie, who lives at the Five Feathers in Barnsley, has learnt to water ski. Mary Dawkins went to find out more.
Harry opened his eyes again. If they had reached water skiing budgerigars, there was nothing else worth hearing. He rolled cautiously onto his front and raised himself onto his knees and elbows, preparing to crawl out from under the window. He had moved about 2 inches when several things happened in very quick succession. A loud, echoing crack broke the sleepy silence like a gunshot. A cat streaked out from under a parked car and flew out of sight. A shriek, a bellowed oath, and the sound of breaking china came from the Dursleys' living room, and as though Harry had been waiting for this signal, he jumped to his feet, at the same time pulling from the waistband of his jeans a thin wooden wand, as if he were unsheathing a sword. But before he could draw himself up to full height, the top of his head collided with the Dursleys' open window, and the resultant crash made Aunt Petunia scream even louder. Harry felt as if his head had been split in two. Eyes streaming, he swayed, trying to focus on the street and spot the source of the noise. But he had barely staggered upright again when 2 large purple hands reached through the open window and closed tightly around his throat.
Put it away,
Uncle Vernon snarled into Harry's ear.
Now, before anyone sees. Get off me,
Harry gasped. For a few seconds they struggled. Harry pulling at his uncle's sausage-like fingers with his left hand, his right maintaining a firm grip on his raised wand. Then, as the pain in the top of Harry's head gave a particularly nasty throb, Uncle Vernon yelped and released Harry as though he had received an electric shock. Some invisible force seemed to have surged through his nephew, making him impossible to hold. Panting, Harry fell forward over the hydrangea bush, straightened up, and stared around. There was no sign of what had caused the loud cracking noise, but there were several faces peering through various nearby windows. Harry stuffed his wand hastily back into his jeans and tried to look innocent.
"Lovely evening,"
shouted Uncle Vernon, waving at Mrs. Number 7, who was glaring from behind her net curtains.
"Did you hear that car backfire just now? Gave Petunia and me quite a turn."
He continued to grin in a horrible, manic way until all the curious neighbors had disappeared from their various windows. Then the grin became a grimace of rage as he beckoned Harry back toward him. Harry moved a few steps closer, taking care to stop just short of the point at which Uncle Vernon's outstretched hands could resume their strangling.
"What the devil do you mean by it, boy?"
asked Uncle Vernon in a croaky voice that trembled with fury. "What do I mean by what?" said Harry coldly. He kept looking left and right up the street, still hoping to see the person who had made the cracking noise.
"Making a racket like a starting pistol, right outside our—"
"I didn't make that noise," said Harry firmly. Aunt Petunia's thin, horsey face now appeared beside Uncle Vernon's wide, purple one. She looked livid.
"Why were you lurking under our window?"
"Yes, yes, good point, Petunia. What were you doing under our window, boy?"
"Listening to the news," said Harry in a resigned voice. His aunt and uncle exchanged looks of outrage.
"Listening to the news? Again?"
"Well, it changes every day, you see," said Harry.
"Don't you be clever with me, boy. I want to know what you're really up to. And don't give me any more of this listening to the news tosh. You know perfectly well that your lot..."
"Careful, Vernon,"
breathed Aunt Petunia. And Uncle Vernon lowered his voice so that Harry could barely hear him.
"That your lot don't get on our news."
"That's all you know," said Harry. The Dursleys goggled at him for a few seconds. Then Aunt Petunia said,
"You're a nasty little liar. What are all those—"
She too lowered her voice so that Harry had to lip-read the next word.
"Howells doing if they're not bringing you news?"
"Aha!"
said Uncle Vernon in a triumphant whisper.
"Get out of that one, boy. As if we didn't know you get all your news from those pestilential birds."
Harry hesitated for a moment. It cost him something to tell the truth this time, even though his aunt and uncle could not possibly know how bad Harry felt at admitting it. "The owls aren't bringing me news," said Harry tonelessly.
"I don't believe it,"
said Aunt Petunia at once.
"No more do I,"
said Uncle Vernon forcefully.
"We know you're up to something funny," said Aunt Petunia.
"We're not stupid, you know," said Uncle Vernon.
"Well, that's news to me," said Harry, his temper rising, and before the Dursleys could call him back, he had wheeled about, crossed the front lawn, stepped over the low garden wall, and was striding off up the street. He was in trouble now, and he knew it. He would have to face his aunt and uncle later and pay the price for his rudeness, but he did not care very much just at the moment. He had much more pressing matters on his mind. Harry was sure that the cracking noise had been made by someone apparating or disapparating. It was exactly the sound Dobby the house elf made when he vanished into thin air. Was it possible that Dobby was here in Privet Drive? Could Dobby be following him right at this very moment? As this thought occurred, he wheeled around and stared back down Privet Drive, but it appeared to be completely deserted again, and Harry was sure that Dobby did not know how to become invisible. He walked on, hardly aware of the route he was taking, for he had pounded these streets so often lately that his feet carried him to his favorite haunts automatically. Every few steps he glanced back over his shoulder. Someone magical had been near him as he lay among Aunt Petunia's dying begonias. He was sure of it. Why hadn't they spoken to him? Why hadn't they made contact? Why were they hiding now? And then, as his feeling of frustration peaked, his certainty leaked away. Perhaps it hadn't been a magical sound after all. Perhaps he was so desperate for the tiniest sign of contact from the world to which he belonged that he was simply overreacting to perfectly ordinary noises. Could he be sure it hadn't been the sound of something breaking inside a neighbor's house? Harry felt a dull, sinking sensation in his stomach, and before he knew it, the feeling of hopelessness that had plagued him all summer rolled over him once again. Tomorrow morning he would be awoken by the alarm at 5 o'clock, so that he could pay the owl that delivered the daily profit. But was there any point in continuing to take it? Harry merely glanced at the front page before throwing it aside these days. When the idiots who ran the paper finally realized that Voldemort was back, it would be headline news, and that was the only kind Harry cared about. If he was lucky, there would also be owls carrying letters from his best friends, Ron and Hermione, although any expectation he had that their letters would bring him news had long since been dashed.
We can't say much about you-know-what, obviously. We've been told not to say anything important in case our letters go astray. We're quite busy, but I can't give you details here. There's a fair amount going on. We'll tell you everything when we see you.
But when were they going to see him? Nobody seemed too bothered with a precise date. Hermione had scribbled,
"I expect we'll be seeing you quite soon,"
inside his birthday card. But how soon was soon? As far as Harry could tell from the vague hints in their letters, Hermione and Ron were in the same place, presumably at Ron's parents' house. He could hardly bear to think of the pair of them having fun at the Burrow when he was stuck in Privet Drive. In fact, he was so angry at them that he had thrown both their birthday presents of Honeydukes chocolates away unopened, though he had regretted this after eating the wilting salad Aunt Petunia had provided for dinner that night. And what were Ron and Hermione busy with? Why wasn't he, Harry, busy? Hadn't he proved himself capable of handling much more than they? Had they all forgotten what he had done? Hadn't it been he who had entered that graveyard and watched Cedric being murdered and been tied to that tombstone and nearly killed? "Don't think about that," Harry told himself sternly for the 100th time that summer. It was bad enough that he kept revisiting the graveyard in his nightmares without dwelling on it in his waking moments, too. He turned a corner into Magnolia Crescent. Halfway along, he passed the narrow alleyway down the side of a garage where he had first clapped eyes on his godfather. Sirius, at least, seemed to understand how Harry was feeling. Admittedly, his letters were just as empty of proper news as Ron and Hermione's, but at least they contained words of caution and consolation instead of tantalizing hints.
"I know this must be frustrating for you. Keep your nose clean and everything will be okay. Be careful and don't do anything rash."
Well, thought Harry, as he crossed Magnolia Crescent, turned into Magnolia Road, and headed towards the darkening play park, he had, by and large, done as Sirius advised. He had at least resisted the temptation to tie his trunk to his broomstick and set off for the Burrow by himself. In fact, Harry thought his behavior had been very good, considering how frustrated and angry he felt at being stuck in Privet Drive this long, reduced to hiding in flower beds in the hope of hearing something that might point to what Lord Voldemort was doing. Nevertheless, it was quite galling to be told not to be rash by a man who had served 12 years in the wizard prison Azkaban, escaped, attempted to commit the murder he had been convicted for in the first place, then gone on the run with a stolen hippogriff. Harry vaulted over the locked park gate and set off across the parched grass. The park was as empty as the surrounding streets. When he reached the swings, he sank onto the only one that Dudley and his friends had not yet managed to break, coiled one arm around the chain, and stared moodily at the ground. He would not be able to hide in the Dursleys' flower bed again. Tomorrow he would have to think of some fresh way of listening to the news. In the meantime, he had nothing to look forward to but another restless, disturbed night, because even when he escaped nightmares about Cedric, he had unsettling dreams about long, dark corridors, all finishing in dead ends and locked doors, which he supposed had something to do with the trapped feeling he had when he was awake. Often the old scar on his forehead prickled uncomfortably, but he did not fool himself that Ron or Hermione or Sirius would find that very interesting any more. In the past, his scar-hurting had warned that Voldemort was getting stronger again, but now that Voldemort was back, they would probably remind him that its regular irritation was only to be expected, nothing to worry about, old news. The injustice of it all welled up inside him, so that he wanted to yell with fury. If it hadn't been for him, nobody would even have known Voldemort was back, and his reward was to be stuck in little whinging for 4 solid weeks, completely cut off from the magical world, reduced to squatting among dying begonias so that he could hear about water-skiing budgerigars. How could Dumbledore have forgotten him so easily? Why had Ron and Hermione got together without inviting him along too? How much longer was he supposed to endure Sirius telling him to sit tight and be a good boy, or resist the temptation to write to the stupid Daily Prophet and point out that Voldemort had returned? These furious thoughts whirled around in Harry's head, and his insides writhed with anger as a sultry, velvety night fell around him, the air full of the smell of warm, dry grass, and the only sound that of the low grumble of traffic on the road beyond the park railings. He did not know how long he had sat on the swing before the sound of voices interrupted his musings, and he looked up. The street lamps from the surrounding roads were casting a misty glow, strong enough to silhouette a group of people making their way across the park. One of them was singing a loud, crude song. The others were laughing. A soft ticking noise came from several expensive racing bikes that they were wheeling along. Harry knew who those people were. The figure in front was unmistakably his cousin, Dudley Dursley, wending his way home accompanied by his faithful gang. Dudley was as vast as ever, but a year's hard dieting and the discovery of a new talent had wrought quite a change in his physique. As Uncle Vernon delightedly told anyone who would listen, Dudley had recently become the junior heavyweight inter-school boxing champion of the Southeast.
The noble sport,
as Uncle Vernon called it, had made Dudley even more formidable than he had seemed to Harry in the primary school days when he had served as Dudley's first punching bag. Harry was not remotely afraid of his cousin anymore, but he still didn't think that Dudley learning to punch harder and more accurately was cause for celebration. Neighborhood children all around were terrified of him, even more terrified than they were of that Potter boy, who, they had been warned, was a hardened hooligan who attended St. Brutus's secure center for incurably criminal boys. Harry watched the dark figures crossing the grass and wondered whom they had been beating up tonight.
"Look round," Harry found himself thinking as he watched them. "Come on, look round. I'm sitting here all alone. Come and have a go."
If Dudley's friends saw him sitting here, they would be sure to make a beeline for him. And what would Dudley do then? He wouldn't want to lose face in front of the gang, but he'd be terrified of provoking Harry. It would be really fun to watch Dudley's dilemma, to taunt him, watch him, with him powerless to respond. And if any of the others tried hitting Harry, Harry was ready. He had his wand.
Let them try.
He'd love to vent some of his frustration on the boys who had once made his life hell. But they did not turn round, they did not see him, they were almost at the railings. Harry mastered the impulse to call after them. Seeking a fight was not a smart move. He must not use magic. He would be risking expulsion again. Dudley's gang's voices died. They were out of sight, heading along Magnolia Road.
"There you go, Sirius," Harry thought dully. "Nothing rash. Kept my nose clean. Exactly the opposite of what you'd have done."
He got to his feet and stretched. Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon seemed to feel that whenever Dudley turned up was the right time to be home, and any time after that was much too late. Uncle Vernon had threatened to lock Harry in the shed if he came home after Dudley again, so stifling a yawn, still scowling, Harry set off toward the park gate. Magnolia Road, like Privet Drive, was full of large square houses with perfectly manicured lawns, all owned by large square owners who drove very clean cars similar to Uncle Vernon's. Harry preferred little whinging by night, when the curtain windows made patches of jewel-bright colours in the darkness, and he ran no danger of hearing disapproving mutters about his delinquent appearance when he passed the householders. He walked quickly, so that halfway along Magnolia Road, Dudley's gang came into view again. They were saying their farewells at the entrance to Magnolia Crescent. Harry stepped into the shadow of a large lilac tree and waited.
"Squealed like a pig, didn't he?"
Malcolm was saying, to guffaws from the others.
"Nice right hook, Big D," said Piers. "Same time tomorrow," said Dudley. "Round at my place. My parents are out," said Gordon. "See you then," said Dudley. "Bye, Dud. See you, Big D."
Harry waited for the rest of the gang to move on before setting off again. When their voices had faded once more, he headed around the corner into Magnolia Crescent, and by walking very quickly, he soon came within hailing distance of Dudley, who was strolling along at his ease, humming tunelessly.
"Hey, Big D."
Dudley turned.
"Oh," he grunted, "it's you."
"How long have you been Big D, then?" said Harry.
"Shut it,"
snarled Dudley, turning away again. "Cool name," said Harry, grinning and falling into step beside his cousin.
but you'll always be Ickle Diddykins to me.
I said, shut it,
said Dudley, whose ham-like hands had curled into fists. Don't the boys know that's what your mum calls you?
Shut your face!
You don't tell her to shut her face. What about Popkin and